everyone, and welcome to Queens of the Bees, your favorite queer movie and TV podcast in hours two. I am TJ, the ever, I say this every week, but emotionally overwrought, needy, dramatic, needs to take a nap, just neurotic mess Pisces. And this is my co-host.
And I'm Aaron.
Who is the
other host of the show.
He's an Aries with all that, that entails, you know, that fire sign energy, which I can't get enough of. And a number of things that we need to say right off the bat. One, we're sorry for having a bit of a break. We've been very busy. A friend of mine has had some loss, so I've been traveling, and it's a little difficult to watch movies and record while on the road, so I just needed to make a little bit of a mea culpa, if you will. Also, this is the day after our anniversary, just to share a little bit of personal business with all of you. 6 long, dreary, wearisome, trial-laden years later, Aaron has put up with me for 6 years. No small accomplishment. And he's also still putting up with me on this podcast. And now, to sort of give us our lead-in, the third sort of housekeeping item is to announce that we've lost yet another queer icon with the passing of Leslie Jordan last week. Which, coupled with the loss of Angela Lansbury a couple of weeks ago, right before we were set to record Bros, is kind of a double whammy for us gays. It's like, we can't get a break. So we thought we would take this opportunity, rather than doing a specific film or TV show this week, although there are plenty of things we're going to be talking about in the days and weeks and months ahead, we wanted to do a little bit of a requiem, I think we could say, for both Leslie Jordan and Angela Lansbury. Because I think it is important to sort of have a full episode to both people, since they were so important to the gay community writ large. And, you know, like I said, there's lots more things to talk about with spooky season. So we're going to have some great episodes coming up. I'll interview with a vampire, both the movie and the TV show, the new season of American Horror Story. But for today, we want to do a little bit, something a little more subdued here at Queens. Mm-hmm. And talk about two queens, as it were. So I wanted to begin with a little bit of a discussion about what makes Leslie Jordan and Angela Lansbury two queer icons, because I think that that's a term, icon, gets thrown around a lot. People are iconic, or so-and-so is a something icon, usually gay. But it's important, I think, as scholars, as Aaron and I both are, to sort of drill down and say what it is we mean. Like, in academia, we need to define our terms. That's how we usually think about it. And so I think it's important to sort of elaborate what we mean.
Yeah, exactly. So before we can say how either Angela Lansbury or Leslie Jordan would qualify as queer icon, we have to define our terms. So queer icon. So TJ, I'll ask you, what's a queer icon?
Well, that's not fair. I was going to ask you what you thought a queer icon was. Well, I actually think that it's best to explain it through Jordan and Lansbury, because I think they represent two very different kinds of queer icon. Because I think that on the one hand, there are gay people and gay actors and queer actors who are iconic.
Yes.
And then on the other hand, there are straight actors who are iconic for gay communities for one reason or another. Gay actors, in my opinion, tend to be those actors that, or gay iconic actors, I should say, are those people that, through both their screen roles and their lives outside of the camera, exemplify something queerly about the world. And if you look at a character like Leslie Jordan, for example, you don't even have to look very far to see how it's true, both on stage and in general life, how he represents a certain kind of queer experience. And what makes it iconic is just the part of it is the intangible thing that makes a star. Like, there's always something vaguely amorphous about stardom, and even more so with queerness. It's like pornography. I know it when I see it, if you'll forget. But I do think that if you look at, say, Brother Boy, which we from Sordid Lies, which we've talked about on this podcast before, you know, you see the way that this diminutive Leslie Jordan, who's like 4'11", I think, something like that, just lives and breathes so much life into that role. And I think that what makes Brother Boy in particular so meaningful is that his own experience, having been like basically imprisoned in a mental hospital, is Jordan being able to articulate for both himself, but also for so many other queer people, the pain of queer life, particularly in the South. And so that's what represents that. And it's even there a little bit with Beverly Leslie,
yes.
arguably his other sort of most recognizable and iconic queer role. You know, everything from the, well, Karen Walker, I thought I smelled gin and regret. You know, it's one of those characters that resonates with us, and you can't help but, like, it's larger than life, but authentic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very tricky thing to pull off. As someone who's also larger than life, but also deeply authentic, I find that really resonant. And so, also, on the other hand, of course, Beverly Leslie didn't just act queerly in his roles. That was him in real life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he spoke about it in his books. He spoke about it in his stage work. You know, he was someone who was very open and unapologetic about his queer life. And I think that that's both what... I think all of that helps to contribute to his iconic status in the sense that it's both easily recognizable, but also emotionally evocative for a large segment. So that's what I would get. I think that's what I would identify as being really key to that particular kind of gay icon.
Okay. So to help me then understand, let's just briefly give me an example of somebody who, of like a famous gay actor that you would say would not be.
Well, in the pregame, I mentioned Zachary Quinto, and I'm only picking on him because he's an American Horror Story, which I've been watching, and, you know, is a very visible gay actor. I don't know necessarily that he's iconic in the same way,
mm-hmm.
or even at all, really. I mean, he's a very capable actor, but I don't think he's iconic.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think that he's a queer icon in the same way.
Nice. And this is maybe a question for later on, but I'm going to want to sort of... I've got some questions about why you have such a different response to those two figures. But like I said, we'll cover some other stuff first and then come back around to that. So I think my questions will make more sense later.
Well, so let me flip it around on you since I've elaborated why I find what kind of queer iconicity Leslie Jordan represents. What do you think is iconic about Leslie Jordan and what makes the queer icon to you more generally?
I think you are you nailed a lot of it already with Leslie Jordan in particular. The idea that sort of in life and on screen is known for portraying this sort of unabashed sense of self. And by that I mean, I don't say this in any way to diminish the sort of acting approaches used by people that we call stars, but people who don't necessarily get lost in a role,
mm-hmm.
but we're always looking at them. Those kinds of actors, I think, tend to function as stars a bit more readily,
right.
like a Leslie Jordan, because of the way he looked and the way he sounded. It's always going to be him.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that you're always going to associate all of his characters with one another. Every role you've ever seen him in, you're going to think about every time you see him in something else.
Right.
Because he's not one of those actors who sort of is subsumed into a role.
Right.
It's always obviously him.
Right. It's kind of like Meryl Streep, but a little bit. Like, mm-hmm. you're always conscious that you're watching Meryl Streep,
mm-hmm.
even if she's doing a very good performance in whoever she happens to be doing,
mm-hmm.
in my opinion, anyway. So, yeah, I think that... And I think that I want to just elaborate a bit on what I said earlier about the fact that he could be both so outlandish, because there's no question that Jordan was an outlandish persona. Like, whether it was as Beverly Leslie, or whether it was as Brother Boy, or any of his other numerous roles, there's just something exuberant about it, though. That's what I think is so exciting about him as a performer, and as an icon, and as a star, is that, you know, he brings such queer joy to the world. Because,
mm-hmm.
but like I said, it's not that he ignored the pain, because we see that a lot, too.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's just a sheer, exuberant, almost transcendent joy in being your authentic self. And that, I think, helps to explain why Jordan is so emblematic for so many queer people of that iconic status.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I'm not from Tennessee, but I am from West Virginia. I am a country boy when it comes down to it. I think that Jordan represents a certain kind of Southern queerness that is not always represented in, like, mainstream culture. Like, he's
mm-hmm.
not a big city queer like we would see in, you know, like, from New York City or Chicago or L.A. or whatever. You know, he's kind of a small town boy when it comes down to it. And I think that that's part of also the reason, because it allows him to have a broader appeal, maybe, than some other queer stars might have.
Mm-hmm. I can buy that.
So on the other hand, to go on to the other dynamic, there's Angela Lansbury, who is a very different kind of queer star,
mm-hmm.
and queer icon, Because obviously,
Wait, are you outing Angela Lansbury?
I was going to say, so far as I know, and, you know, I'm not saying that I'm an Angela Lansbury expert, but I do know a lot about her. She's not, wasn't queer, although she did marry a gay man. That is what, that is an important biographical note, that her first husband was gay. So that, so that right away sort of primes the pump
that,
for her.
That gives her honorary membership.
So she was pretty much destined to be a gay icon, because, I mean, honestly, really, you know. But like other sort of dames, shall we say, the Ethel Mermans, the Patti LuPones, the Judy Garlands, the Madonnas, well, the Madonna might have just come out, so that's a whole different thing. But my point being, you know, these, Bette Midler, there we go, there's another one. So, you know, these larger than life personas that are women that are appealing to gay men and also to lesbians. Like, let's be real. I mean, we don't want to exclude lesbians from this dynamic. But it is true that, like, these kinds of stars tend to appeal to gay men. And there's been entire books written about why gay men find this kind of femininity attractive. But for the moment, I'll just say that because gay men typically are more in touch with their emotions, some of us. Some of us are more in touch with our emotions. I feel like we have a, I don't want to be essentialist, but it is almost a spiritual connection with strong femininity that I think that straight men don't always have. I wish they did. I think the world would be a much better place if they did worship at the altar of strong women like we do. But I do think that that's part of the explanation for why she is so strongly identified with the gay community. There's a lot of other reasons why she's iconic, because she acted in movies like Gaslight, which was directed by George Cukor himself, a noted gay icon and very queer director. In the picture of Dorian Gray, or Portrait of Dorian Gay, also a very gay movie. But arguably...
And of course all the musical theaters.
Well, I was just going to say, arguably, the thing that cemented her place in the pantheon of queer icons was, of course, playing as Mame in the Broadway show of the same name. Because the movie, Anti-Mame, the original, like, with Rosalind Russell, is also a gay film. I mean, it's clear that her nephew is gay, and, like, it's just, it's obvious. But, you know, Angela Lansbury herself spoke about the way that Mame represented for so many of her gay audiences glory and glamour and all that sort of, more glamour than glory. But I think it's actually deeper than that, because I do think that Mame is unequivocally accepting of people.
Yes.
And so I think that that's something that gay men yearn for. Like, I mean, all people yearn for their mother's affection, but I think that because stereotypically it's true that gay men have a profound relationship to their mothers and their grandmothers, I think that also helps to explain why so many gay men felt themselves drawn to her as a figure. Not just because Lansbury was such, you know, played such strong women, but also because there is just something, the relationship between gay men and the women in their life is real and it's deep. And I think that that helps to explain it too.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think that that's an important, so I find it really productive to juxtapose Leslie Jordan with Angela Lansbury, just because, like I said, they represent two different axes of queer iconicity. And I think that that's part of why it hurts so much when they leave us. Because they just, they come to mean something very important. And I think for queer people in particular, we're, historically speaking, have been so shut out of popular culture, like either shut out altogether or just so deeply pathologized or other kinds of ways, you know, the history of Hollywood has not been particularly friendly to queer people. I think that helps to explain why we latch on to these figures so steadfastly and why it's, as I said, so heartbreaking when they leave us.
Yeah. I also think there's something to it, where it's not just sort of, you know, Hollywood being not so great to queer folks, but Hollywood actually doing its job of popularizing stuff. Remember, we're especially when we're talking about these figures from, you know, previous generations, that the sort of the mass mediated images that they got of anything that they would associate with queer would be one of only a handful of things they'd ever get.
Right.
But also would be something that they shared sort of across this thing that we might call a queer community. It's like those were sort of the icons were shared.
Right.
And I think there's something important about that that I think gets at what I brought up before when I was asking you about why you thought someone like a Zachary Quinto wouldn't be an icon. Because I wonder if we can have icons now?
Well, that's actually a really good question, and I want to dwell on that for a couple minutes, because I think that's a broader question about, like, what queer means in the age of acceptance. Mm-hmm. Like, and that's something I think about a lot. I mean, my friend and I are actually working on a book on exactly that, sort of exactly that question. Because mm-hmm. I think that what you're getting at is that, you know, we live in this age of increased visibility. That, you know, we have, as we've talked about on this podcast, like, numerous gay movies and TV shows that are coming out seemingly all the time. Queer as Folk, Heartstopper, you know, has, I wouldn't say normalized exactly, but I would say made more palatable and more, like, visible, mm-hmm. the kind of, like, queerness that makes it, it's also easier for gay, for stars to come out as gay. Like, mm-hmm. that's not the death sentence to one's career it might have been yeah. even a decade ago. And all of which is just a long way towards saying that I think that part of the reason that a Lansbury or a Jordan particularly can read as so iconic is because their bravery in those moments was true bravery. Like, it cost something mm-hmm. for someone like Leslie Jordan to be openly mm-hmm. queer in Hollywood
yeah.
in a way that it doesn't necessarily cost now. And so that adds an extra layer of pathos to his performance mm-hmm. and, like, the fact that he was so willing to be so unapologetic in who he was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And even thinking about that, I'm thinking now too about, I'm trying to picture a Leslie Jordan having a career that would have looked anything different from what he had, for all of the same reasons that you're talking about. Someone like a Leslie Jordan, for all kinds of reasons, not to mention his sort of obvious queerness, was never going to be like a leading man type figure. That was just never going to be him.
Right.
And so I wonder if there's something to the way to find success, mm-hmm. Given his sort of deviation from sort of normative masculinity in all right. kinds of ways, was to lean into all of the stuff that made him different.
Right.
That's what then gave him a reason to stick out and be notable that way.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking, like, there's something very, because for most of his career, up until, like, the last decade, probably, Jordan was mostly a supporting actor, a character actor. Mm-hmm. Like, he was one of those people who'd be, like, a walk-on role. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Beverly Leslie is a good, you know, example of that. And he owned it. But, I mean, because I think there's always something vaguely queer about most character actors, mm-hmm. just because of the fact that they kind of float around at the edges of the narrative that we normally expect and all the normativity that represents.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, it's really striking that as his career advanced and he became like this huge, like truly huge star on Instagram, like millions of followers,
mm-hmm.
but also got more starring roles in his own shows, like The Cool Kids and Call mm-hmm. Me Cat, which was what he was on his way to film when he died. It's kind of sad, but also fitting that, you know, he would see this moment of triumph so late in his career, mm-hmm. but I mean, for what else was he working except to, like, achieve, like, that mm-hmm. sort of, you know, late career renaissance?
Exactly, and because I think that that's exactly what fits his persona for his sort of more substantial leading role, where he's not just sort of, you know, a guest character, someone coming in on something like The Cool Kids,
right.
where he's, but it's still an ensemble show. It's not like right. it's a starring show vehicle for him. It's an ensemble, but still, it adds the extra layer of him not just being sort of this quirky, not normatively masculine gay man, but he's also old now.
Right.
Like, and that seems so appropriate for that to be what's embraced mm-hmm. in his sort of most leading TV role that we can think of.
Right, and it's so interesting to me. Like, I'm thinking about his role in Will and Grace, where, you know, he's Beverly Leslie, and how much pleasure I take in that character. Like, because mm-hmm. I think that's another key component of iconicity that I didn't mention, is just how much pleasure we take in seeing these people on screen. Because
mm-hmm.
I think a lot about pleasure, because it's one of the things I sort of, that's why I watch things. I don't typically watch things that make me not feel pleasure. Like, whether it's boredom or just antipathy, I tend to, like, even crying in emotions is pleasurable for me, like, as weird as masochistic as that sounds. And so there's just something really fun about Leslie Jordan as a character actor. Like, in any role in which he appears, I just enjoy seeing him on stage mm-hmm. or on screen. And I like that even in, like, American Horror Story, where he, like, would briefly appear, because, you know, I think that that's a testament to Ryan Murphy also hiring queer people. And so I think that that's part of another aspect of iconicity that I appreciate, is just enjoying seeing people on the screen.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I want to talk a little bit then about, because we've really privileged Jordan for a moment. So let's switch gears just a little bit to give the dame her due, mm-hmm. which admittedly I did talk about her a lot during Bro, like the special segment during Bros, but I, you know, I don't want to ignore her, because I do think that, you know, she's also someone who only experienced like true superstardom late in her career, which is itself a kind of queer act if you think about mm-hmm. it, you know, because, you know, nowadays she's arguably best known for two roles, Jessica Fletcher on Murder, She Wrote, and Mrs. Potts mm-hmm. in Beauty and the Beast, both of which occurred after she was in her 60s. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's a real testament to also the degree to which one can work toward, you know, and only achieve one's success later in one's career. And I, like I said, I think there's something delightfully queer about that, because it doesn't follow the usual trajectory that we associate with, like, stardom, where you become the big star that you are, the leading person in your 20s and 30s, and then mm-hmm. fade into obsolescence.
Right.
But in this case, they both have an opposite effect, that they work in, you know, largely bit parts, except for Lansbury having some success on stage, and then really become the household names that they are mm-hmm. only late in their lives.
Yeah, and it's like, I read her pathway to success a little bit differently, but because there is, for me at least, there's a common story there that can be said about a number of sort of older women actress who've sort of been near and dear to the hearts of us gay boys and men for so long. And that's the ones who start out like Lansbury, finding, you know, establishing successful careers at young ages.
Right.
And then as they age and as they grow and as different kinds of opportunities arise, they change themselves.
Right.
To fit the new opportunities that are now appropriate for them at whatever phase they're in, so that they sort of grow with all of us. You know, on the music side, I would compare it to someone like, say, a Madonna, who manages to sort of like reinvent herself over and over and over and over and over again,
right?
To turn into someone that keeps getting talked about and ended up having a really long career. Lansbury does the same thing with her early stage work, earlier movie roles, then more stage work, then right. television roles. as she aged and as these different media became viable for someone of her type, she just kind of embraced them.
Right. And I mean, I've been thinking a lot about this, because I've been thinking about Murder, She Wrote in particular, because, you know, some shows, like, from the 80s, you know, and with older ladies, I'm thinking of course, the Golden Girls. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, is the queerness and the queer appeal is more transparent. Like, it's obvious to me why the Golden Girls are queer icons. Like, there's mm-hmm. there's diegetic reasons why that's the case. Both because they address queer issues, they talk, you know, there's the queer bond between them, the power of female friendship, all the sort of, you know, implied get lesbianic overtones. Like, that stuff makes sense why mm-hmm. they would be. But I've been struck by, you know, as soon as Lansbury's death was announced, I was really struck by how many gay men talked about watching Murder, She Wrote and sort of seeing, getting gay comfort. Because I can't think, in some ways, of a more heteronormative show. Not heteronormative, actually, but Murder, She Wrote is less open for queer appropriation in its way than The Golden Girls. Yeah. At first blush, anyway. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, obviously, Jessica is single and an empowered woman in later life, but there's not a lot of gay characters in Murder, She Wrote, and it's just a different kind of show. Like, exactly. It's not an edgy, issues-driven show in the same way that Golden Girls is. So in that sense, I'm even more struck by the way that a lot of gay men came through a circuitous route, but really did see in the show a way of, like, forging their own queer identity. Like, I just found that a very mm-hmm. interesting phenomenon, because it gave voice to something that I suspected to be true of my own self, but I needed someone else to put it into words because I couldn't quite figure it out.
Yeah, and I wonder, though, for that, how much of what you just said being true is because of stuff that a lot of folks see in the show itself, and how much of it is because the men that you're talking about maybe have memories of watching the show with their mothers or their grandmothers, and that's why they're making these sort of associations, is because the watching of the show was bound up in those memories.
Well, that's what I think is certainly the case with myself. You know, as my listeners know, and as pretty much anybody who knows me know, you know, I had a very deep and rich connection with my own maternal grandmother, and we did watch Murder, She Wrote. And so I do think that you're right to identify that as one of the key reasons, because obviously Murder, She Wrote skewed. I mean, everybody loved it, but it definitely was an older person kind of show, especially once it entered, like, Hallmark and the sort of contemporary TV sphere. And so I think that it is something, there is a lot of nostalgia bound up with that. And I think that is itself an interesting phenomenon, the way that television and certain kinds of shows and certain kinds of figures like Lansbury can forge sometimes unexpected connections between queer people and other parts of their family, which that doesn't get as commented upon as I think it should.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, you know, a while ago, when my grandmother was still alive and just after Doris Day had passed away, another kind of queer icon who was as straight as they come, but still was very beloved by many queer people. And I remember thinking about how watching Doris Day with my grandmother helped forge a connection, and how I suspected, and I still suspect, that my grandmother, like many women of that generation where I grew up, kind of relished the opportunity to have a young boy to watch this stuff with that wasn't as hung up on the trappings of gender performance as many boys in Appalachia tend to be. So I think that that's part of the reason that these shows and these figures like Angela Lansbury, I think, continue to have that queer appeal.
Yeah, definitely. That, you know, changed the Appalachia part. You're describing my experience, too.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that that's part of the legacy that they leave behind. And so I want to talk a little bit more then about death, because that's the other thing I think a lot about, is death, as Aaron can attest. It's just one of those things that I'm fascinated and terrified by. But also, you know, because I'm recalling when Betty White passed away and how, like, emotionally devastated I was. Again, part of that has to do with my own feelings about my grandmother passing, but I do think that as a culture, we tend to collectively mourn certain kinds of stars. Like, that's part of, I find star death very fascinating as a kind of cultural phenomenon. And so I wondered if we could sort of dive into that a little bit more. So what are some of your thoughts about, like, star death and how we as a culture use that as kind of a way of coping with our own individual grieving processes?
Well, I'm not going to answer your question directly. I was actually going to answer with a little bit of a twist and say that I think that star death, for the way that I want to talk about it for this, can kind of function as this sort of weird repository for a lot of our otherwise unacknowledged emotions about people and relationships and all of that kind of stuff, that the loss of, you know, of a figure like a star, I was about to say a public figure, but it's even different if it were someone who was like a politician or something.
Right.
Seriously, someone from entertainment, like a star, that the loss of that person who, you know, if we step back and look at it, sure, they gave some performances that made us happy. We had some good times watching them, but it's not like they did much, like, in our lives.
Right.
But when it feels like we're really losing someone, I wonder how often that's sort of a way of feeling stuff in a safer context than dealing with the loss of someone whose loss is actually more directly felt. Like, my day-to-day life didn't change when Angela Lansbury died, when Betty White died. Nothing about my day-to-day life actually changes when those things happen. But when, say, someone's in my family goes, there's an actual direct change. And I wonder if sometimes our focus on celebrity death and star death is a way around dealing with other kinds of grieving.
See, I would actually say that it's the opposite. I would actually say that it provides, like, I think that collectively we grieve in a way that, how do I want to put this? Because I read this really great essay from Vox about the way that, because it was right about the time that both Bob Saget and Betty White died around the same time, and how, like, because of their ubiquity and the kind of star text that they had, that many people, when they were grieving that death, it was kind of like they were grieving a member of their own family. Like, I take your point that it doesn't affect our everyday life.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that I agree with you that grieving for, in this case, an Angela Lansbury or a Leslie Jordan is a way of avoidance. I think it's just another, it's a way of us grieving someone that meant a lot to us as a community, which feels different than if we had just lost on an individual basis. Yeah. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. And to be clear, I'm not saying that... I wouldn't say avoidance before, but I think it's sort of... in an odd way, sort of a proxy. And but what you just said makes me refine this even more. There's some... because you're right, there's something to this idea about there being sort of these shared experiences of grief that we can have with a celebrity because they're so well known that we can't have with, say, people that are closer to us that are only known to our much smaller social circles. But when someone public is lost, that's kind of, it's sort of like it creates sort of an acceptable time for grieving.
Uh-huh.
And that can be a convenient thing, frankly, for right. if you're carrying around grief for other stuff, too. It's like, well, everybody's kind of mourning right now, so now is a time for mourning.
Right. And I mean, I will say that one thing that strikes me about the death of queer icons, especially like screen icons, mm-hmm. is that their legacy literally lives on in a moving form. I mean, sure, we have like, you know, we have home videos, we have photos of our loved ones, but there's something I think... uniquely powerful and uniquely like resonant. What's the word I want to look for? That strikes us differently when we can see their screen roles. Like even though mm-hmm. obviously we know that Leslie Jordan is gone, we know that Angela Lansbury is gone, we still have their screen roles and their like it's preserved for us. Like mm-hmm. and I think that there's something unique about that that we don't necessarily have with our own loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think that. Because our experience of our loved ones that we actually know is not mediated in mm-hmm. the same way.
Yeah.
Like, we're not... our experience and encounters with our grandparents or our parents or our siblings or what have you are immediate and mm-hmm. lived. Whereas our encounters, unless we're very fortunate or we happen to be a member of Angela Lansbury's family or Leslie Jordan's family, mm-hmm. like, it's only accessible through... the screen yeah. through their star text, through the way that we've already engaged with them for so much.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just think it's really, I find it personally very fascinating the way that we engage with these people that we don't actually know. Mm-hmm. But because, I mean, it's just one of those like thoroughly modern phenomena. Like it's sort of, it would never have happened in previous periods. It's only a function of like our mass media
yeah.
and stardom driven lives that this is even rendered possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I also think there's something to the idea that like our relationships with screen icons are ideal.
Right.
Because they exist only with, you know, this, you know, the photons of light bouncing off of the screen. Right. Since that's all there is to right. that relationship. They're sort of ideal, whereas the relationships with actual, you know, people that we have real life connections with are always far more complicated.
Right. So, I mean, in that sense, I take your point about earlier when you were talking about, like, how grieving for these... I think that it... I want to rephrase that. I think that our grieving for these queer icons is itself an idealized form of grieving
mm-hmm.
in a way that it very rarely is in our everyday lived life. Like, you know, in a few weeks from now, yes, I'll still be sad about Leslie Jordan, but I won't be affected by it.
Mm-hmm.
And the grief won't leave the scar
yeah.
that my grandmother's death is just the most recent example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think that that's the idealized form of grief. Like, we can feel the poignancy of it, the piercing of it, and then we can move on. Like,
mm-hmm.
You know, because the only thing that's going to be is that we're not going to get any more Leslie Jordan mm-hmm. on TV. We're not going to get any more Angela Lansbury on film. So yeah. I think that that's kind of... lovely, but also depressing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also that, you know, there's no unresolved issues in my relationship with Angela Lansbury. That type of thing.
Right.
That's why I think you're, you know, calling it that sort of like idealized form of grief, I think is a great way to think about it. It's because it's not bound up in all of the other stuff that real life grief
right.
always comes with.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that I don't know that I would have my actual grief be idealized. And so I think that in that sense, mourning queer icons is clearly like a communal function and is I think one of the important things about like being part of a subculture
mm-hmm.
is that it's one of those things that you wouldn't necessarily want to be in your everyday lived life.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it fulfills a different emotional function than like actual grief, like real life grief does. Mm-hmm. Does it make sense what I'm saying? Yes. Like it serves different purposes for us psychologically speaking.
Yeah. There's something sort of like ritualistic, sort of community oriented about sort of like the when we say goodbye to Betty White, like when we went to that movie thing,
right? Or
the movie theater thing with her birthday,
right? Exactly. I think about like the Fire Island Widows and things like that. Mm-hmm. Sort of ritualized grieving that is very specific to queer people, because I think that we as queer people have a different relationship with loss than I think many straight people do.
Mm-hmm.
Which leads me into like why I think both Lansbury and Jordan in their own ways are so important as queer icons, because they both are sort of living legacies of previous periods. For Lansbury, obviously she's one of the last living icons of golden age cinema, which obviously has always had a special place in the heart of many queer people like me. But also because she gave to AIDS charities, like like many other Hollywood stars, so that's an important thing. But also with Leslie Jordan, you know, who, as I was mentioning to you in the pregame, like, was, and as you yourself know, you know, was part of the lost generation of gay men.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was born in, you know, whatever it was, 40-something, and so came of age during the AIDS crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and that's... that kind of thing leaves a scar on you, even if you have not, even if you yourself do not die of AIDS. But I mean, Leslie Jordan certainly knew many people who did, and was in fact quite active with, you know, with working with AIDS patients and delivering food and things of that sort. So he is, in his body, like his own physical body, was a reminder of what we've lost.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's, I don't know, for me, that's just deeply powerful.
Yeah. And that you bring this up in this way sort of gets at the question I asked you earlier about sort of the possibility of other icons. Like, could we have these kinds of queer icons today? What sort of conditions do you think lead to that? Because as it happened historically, a lot of the reasons for us looking to certain figures like Leslie Jordan had to do with frankly, the horrible shit that our community faced in the past. But as things thankfully get a bit better, what's the impetus for seeking out an icon, for creating an icon out of someone when you don't have the problems of the past to try to deal with?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good question, because as you were asking that, I was trying to think of anybody. I'm say our generation from like the 30s to, like to their early 40s, who could either now or in the near future be sort of understood to be a queer icon. And I'm kind of struggling. Like,
yeah.
I mean, maybe, I was going to say Deborah Messing, but she's too old. Like, I mean, she's in her 50s now.
Exactly.
So even that is still just faintly too old. And maybe some of the drag queens from Drag Race, which I don't watch enough to be able to speak about it authoritatively. Yeah. Because I think that that's one, and I'm not saying that I want us to go back to the period of, like, queer people being persecuted. God knows we're already close enough to it as it is.
Yeah, don't give the other side ideas.
Right, I mean, we're already dealing with, you know, the resurgence of, you know, the groomer myth and all that shit. So it may be that, you know, as the pendulum swings against us now, that we might find ourselves once again needing icons. Because, I mean, I think that's the ancillary or the corollary to your question, I think. And I'm dancing around it because I don't actually have an answer. Because I don't know. Can you think of anyone of our age who would qualify as an icon?
Well, it's even for me, it's trying to figure out, like, what are they an icon for?
Right.
Is the thing. Because I'm like, I guess... There's still advocacy work that has to get done, but it's being done by so many people now.
Right.
That it's hard to, I don't know why I would pick one and call them an icon.
Right. I mean, because, you know, obviously, I'm even struggling to think of, like, actresses, to flip it onto the other end of the axis. Like, who are the gay icons of the dames? I mean, most of the ones I can think of, like, Cate Blanchett, Nicole Kidman, you know, those are still older. Like, there's you know, I'm struggling to think even of, like, any actresses of my generation who I would qualify as, like, having that kind of larger-than-life dame persona.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that there are any.
Yeah. And maybe that sort of persona is just sort of a relic of a bygone era.
Right. I mean, I suspect it may have something to do with the lack of, like, that stardom works differently. That Hollywood is not a star-driven industry in the same way that it used to be. Mm-hmm. Like, even 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Like, it's an industry that doesn't rely as strongly on stars to sell things. Mm-hmm. It's franchises and maybe directors sometimes.
Yeah.
And action stars. That's basically what it achieves. Mm-hmm. But I want to, maybe as we edge up toward edge, as we...
Wow.
I know. Pardon me. I had to inject some levity to this rather somber discussion. As we're sort of moving toward our conclusion, I do want to think a little bit more broadly about what function, culturally speaking, icons serve. Because I think that that's a good way of sort of capping what we're talking about. Because, you know, this is, and that's the, as I said, that's the corollary to your query. That's a nice little rhyme. is why do we need icons? And I think that, because icon obviously is a religious term. Like, it's used... That's sort of its origins, is in religious religious worship.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's, for many, and certainly like within the Eastern Orthodox tradition, like icons are intermediaries between the human and the divine. And thinking about it that way, I think, is really interesting in terms of queer people.
Because
What is it that we're seeking access to?
Right.
What would you say?
I don't know that I have an answer to that question for a modern era. Nor do I... I'm going to ask and answer my own question, or ask and not answer my own question, where the need for an intermediary, and like, is our society still structured in a way where we look for folks to perform that kind of role? Or do we sort of expect direct access to the things that we want?
That's a good... Well, yes. Because I think that you're right. And that's part of what makes Leslie Jordan so interesting, is that he was an icon who was very accessible. Especially through, like, the Instagram thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way that stardom works. Like, we expect immediate access because of social media and all that shit.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, obviously very different than Lansbury, who, like, I couldn't tell you the last time she had made, like, a public appearance. Let alone in an alternate timeline, Angela Lansbury also had a TikTok account.
Like, yes.
Yeah, like that would have been...
Oh, what we missed. That's what we should have had.
Right, that was the parallel universe. That was the one, you know, that was the best timeline.
Yes.
We're at the worst timeline, but that's the best timeline, is the one where Angela Lansbury had a TikTok. Anyway, but I think that you're right, that maybe it may be the case that in previous eras, when queer people were more traditionally shut out of the avenues of power and representation, that we sought out icons because they gave us access to those realms. Like, that for, you know, an Angela Lansbury gave us access to glamour, to acceptance, to love and comfort and joy.
Mm-hmm.
For Leslie, it was living life as one would love to be able to do, you know, and living out and proud and flamboyant and thrashing and just demolishing gendered expectations. Maybe, like, we don't need those anymore. But that's precisely why I think that it's so important to acknowledge what they accomplished and to acknowledge their status, because that kind of history is important. And I think that we live in a very presentist age, thanks in part to things like TikTok, where everything just blurs together into some amorphous blob of the ever-present.
Yes. And now is all there is, now is all there has ever been, now is all there ever will be.
You laugh, but I mean, I know you know that that's basically how a lot of people behave, and so it's like, it's all the more vital that we acknowledge what these icons did for us, and continue to do, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so why we need to sort of pay attention to them.
Yeah, exactly.
So that seems like, I think, it feels like to me like that's a good place to wrap up. I think that this has been a really fascinating discussion about the way that queer icons work, and hopefully we'll still have some queer icons, because I like having things to worship, so maybe we'll still have them without all the oppression. But that's a larger question that maybe we can leave for another day.
Works for me.
All right. Okay. Okay, well, in lieu of Are You Even Gay, I'm going to give Aaron a week off this week. I think he gets a little tired of me giving him a hard time for his lack of gayness.
I can take it.
Yeah, I'm skeptical about that claim. We thought we would do a little bit of a gay essay this week because we're coming up on the midterms.
Mm-hmm.
Ba-da-ba-da, you know, which, you know, if you're like me, you feel an ever-creeping sense of dread, as I always do when it comes to election season. But particularly this year because, I mean, the polling is not great in terms of gay people. And it's, I meant to say for Democrats, but.
Well, same thing.
But it's a Freudian slip.
Yeah, polling. But before we delve into the bad news, let's say something good. There are a record number of LGBTQ candidates.
That is true.
You know, on the ballot across the country. So that's a good thing.
Right. So, yes, that is a very good thing to mention. Thank you for that. So, I do not want to assume that all queer people are Democrats. I know that is not true, but I will point out, I think it is worth, you know, elaborating, that the Republican Party, as it is currently construed, is no ally of the LGBT community, and in fact is quite the opposite.
Wait, I'm stunned to hear this. I know.
It may come as a surprise to some of you to learn that Republicans have made, once again, queer people their favorite punching bag when it comes to electoral politics. Mm. And that's been true for decades, but every time I think, oh, well, you know, maybe they've learned their lesson and maybe, you know, the general set, you know, the general population's sympathy toward queer people extends to Republicans. Let me be clear, it does not.
I am just shocked.
I mean, we have seen obviously a lot of the attention has been on the anti-trans legislation, which some of it is truly, truly noxious, particularly yes. In Florida. Like, the extent to which many people feel, deep antipathy toward trans people is, to me, quite mind-boggling. I do not understand why it is so entrenched, but be that as it may, I just think it's horrifying, and I think that it's important to, like, raise awareness of why midterms matter, because obviously, historically speaking, it's difficult to get people motivated for the midterms. Do not sleep on the midterms. It doesn't matter whether you're motivated or not. I promise you that Republican voters and Republican legislators are motivated, and they are going to continue using queer people as their favorite opportunity to motivate their voters to get out and vote against us.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's our duty as citizens to continue to, like, to vote. Like, I mean, I think that's one of the things that, I don't want to say, I don't want to paint us with too broad of a brush, but, you know, gay people can get a little bit complacent.
Yes.
Especially in the era after Obergefell, where everyone's like, oh, yay, we've got gay marriage. That's mm-hmm. it. But we know now that obviously this is not going to be the end of it, that they're going to continue to pursue at both legislative and judicial appointments and so forth a very strident agenda that is really toxic. And, like, mm-hmm. and it has, like, actual material consequences for actual people.
Yes.
And I think that's really worth pointing out. Like, it's not just rhetoric. And we see this in the way that people, like, try to shut down drag story time, which I really don't, like, I'm just going to pause for a moment and say, I do not understand why parents get so hung up about drag story time. Like, why is that such a flashpoint for them?
They don't want their kids knowing stories.
I mean, I find clowns far more terrifying than I find drag queens. So if I had, you know, but we don't see the kind of protests against clown story time that we see against drag queens.
You want to go up against clowns? Are you crazy?
Well, I mean, John Wayne Gacy would say, you know, that's all.
Exactly. Clowns, I'm fine with all of you.
But I mean, I do think that, you know, it, like I said, it's easy to get complacent. It's easy to forget that the midterms matter and that control of the House and the Senate is vital to protecting both queer rights, but also, you know, as we've talked about on this podcast before, like, abortion is a queer issue too. Like, mm-hmm. and it's really, really important that we get that as protected as we possibly can. Yes.
And importantly, like, not only is abortion also a queer issue, every issue is a queer issue. Everything that's on your ballot, wherever you happen to live in this country, is a queer issue.
Right. And I mean, it's also worth pointing out that, you know, it's very common for people in blue states or in blue cities to be like, well, why do I care, you know, if if XY state does XY. Well, because queer people live there too. Like, there are going to be people living in Alabama, in Arkansas, in Florida, and all these other places are easily subjected to these kinds of noxious legislative efforts. So it's important to give them support as much as we possibly can, and to, you know, vote in state and local elections, because that's the other thing that people tend to forget, that a lot of the anti-LGBT stuff that gets put out there is done at the local level, and so it flies under the radar because of the nationalization of our elections. People don't tend to pay attention to what happens at the local level, and that's a dangerous habit to get into. Like, it's really, really important to pay attention to what's happening at your city council meeting, school board meeting, at your state house. Like, that stuff is important. Educate yourself. I'm sorry to keep hectoring, but it's important because I feel like it's something that, you know, tends to fly under the radar and is really to our collective detriment.
Yes.
So please vote. It is, after all, National LGBT History Month. I don't know if anyone knew that. I certainly knew it, but I'm just pointing that out. So it would be a shame if in the midterms we suffered some losses. So in honor of our predecessors, like Leslie Jordan, like so many others who have fought and done the hard work, it's up to us to carry on that legacy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to bring it back to what we said earlier, if we don't want to slide back into an era of like widespread persecution, which is much closer than people ever really think, that's the thing that scares me, then I think that we need to be really proactive in making sure that Republicans don't gain control. I know that we're going to do our part here in Maryland, where we're going to be voting for Heather Mazur for the House congressional seat. She's a lesbian. I love that. This is the second year, by the way, here in our own little corner of rural Maryland that we've had an LGBTQ person running for election. I don't know that she'll win, but I'm certainly going to do my part to help her. So, again, just to reiterate, it's really important that you vote in your local elections. So consider that your little PSK from us here at Queens of the Bees. Not exactly cultural related, but as I said, it's important to carry on the legacies of our forebearers, like the late and beloved Leslie Jordan and Dame Angela Lansbury.
Vote.
All right, we'll give it just a moment to freshen up, and we'll be right back to give you our little farewell. All right, well, I should have said this at the beginning, but I'm going to say it now. Happy Halloween. I will be releasing this episode on Halloween. So, you know, I apologize for not having another spooky-themed episode, but as I said, we have a lot more spooky stuff coming up. And this one's for Jarrell, who I know hates this term. Spooky season may be over, but we're going to have a lot more creepy content here at Queens of the Bees. So, that being said, I'm not even going to bother asking Aaron where I can find him on social media, because it's a waste of time, and it just makes him feel bad, because I know he wishes he were more plugged into the social media sphere.
I regret nothing at all.
You probably shouldn't. With the news that Elon Musk has bought Twitter, it just caused that everything is awful, so you're probably just as well that you're not on Twitter. But if you want to follow me on Twitter for the limited time that I may yet be on that platform, now that Elon Musk owns it, you can follow me at TJ West in the number 3. You can also follow me on Instagram at Thomas West in the number 3. And you can follow us on Instagram at Queens of the Bees, which now that I think about it, reads out as Queens of the BS. But that seems appropriate given, you know, what the nature of the conversation here we have at Queens sometimes. Anyway, follow us on there. You can get bite-sized reviews of the various things that we're watching, both things that we review on the pod, but also the wide range of movies and TV shows that Aaron and I watch on a regular basis, and the occasional book thrown in here I do read, you know. So that one's also for Jarrell, so I'm just giving a little sting to one of my fellow co-hosts. But please do follow us on there. We love connecting with new people all the time. And speaking of which, if you have an extra moment, please take an extra time to rate or review us wherever you get your podcast, particularly on Apple. I say this every week, but it's worth reiterating that if you want our beloved little podcast, and we know you love us as much as we love you, to grow and flourish and become more successful and be able to retire and just do podcasting full time, if you want us to be able to do that, we need to grow. So please leave us comments, feedback. We have some very good reviews on Apple Podcasts, although we have one-star review, so whoever you are out there that left us the one-star review, let me just say that we
we appreciate your feedback.
They didn't leave any feedback. That's the problem. But please do rate us. We prefer 5-star reviews if you can bring yourself to do it. 4 stars are also acceptable. Anything less, you know, just keep it to yourself. If you have any reviews, though, please share those. If it's positive, CC, you know, make sure you carbon copy me. If not, Aaron will be happy to field all complaints that you may have. And we do take those into account sometimes. But anyway, please do rate or review us if you have a chance, because it really does help us to grow, and we do look forward to continuing to bring more great quality Queens Thebes content to all of you. So I think that is everything for this week, now that I've word vomited at them repeatedly. Happy Halloween. Happy LGBT History Month. So for Queens Thebes, I'm your co-host TJ.
And I'm Aaron.
And we'll be right back with you next week.